Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard. Be alert. You do not know when that time will come. It's like a man going away. He leaves his house and puts his servants in charge, each with his assigned task, and tells the one at the door to keep watch. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know when the owner of the house will come back, whether in the evening or at midnight or when the rooster crows or at dawn. If he comes suddenly, do not let him find you sleeping. What I say to you, I say to everyone, watch.
Well, first grade Bible presentation is just one of my very favorite things here. Isn't that great to see those kids up here on stage and to see their beautiful faces and our elders, how they look before they take them out to lunch? I really appreciate our elders doing that. The elders are taking them to Stevie B's, and the reason they go to Stevie B's is because they used to go to Mickey D's, and the kids would get them out on the playground and try to force them to go down through the slides and stuff. So the elders decided this was an easier way. There's no playground there. So I really appreciate them doing that. This group of elders was off on a retreat all weekend, and they prayed for each one of you by name. Now, your name was brought up to the Father in prayer. So I appreciate the love they have for this family, they and their wives. It is special to see these kids up here and their parents, and in times like that, when they're so beautiful, we forget how absolutely terrifying some of those first hours when they were coming into the world, really were. Right? Do you remember those times for you? I heard about a guy who his wife went into labor, and he got really upset, and he panicked, and so he called 911. And the 911 operator listened to him for just a minute, and then she said, "Sir, is this your wife's first baby?" And he said, "Of course not. This is her husband." Now, for myself, after attending a whole bunch of childbirth classes, I really thought I pretty much had it down, and I knew how this was going to work and everything. But when we went to the hospital with Paul, I found it to be a little more terrifying than I thought. But I breathed just like they taught you to at the childbirth classes, and it was not painful at all, I can promise you for that. I can't imagine how women who've never felt birth pains feel when they go in that first moment, when those start, the questions that must come for them, the fear that must rise up, inside of them on that first time, or the second time, I guess, or for the third time too, I'm sure. Birth pains get your attention. That's what birth pains are designed to do. Mark chapter 13 here is about birth pains. Jesus even uses the word. He says, these things are like birth pains. So it's about how to understand them and how not to panic when they roll in. There are different opinions about what Jesus is talking about here in chapter 13 of Mark. Some people think Jesus is talking about going to heaven or about the end of the world. But Jesus isn't talking about the end of the world so much as he's talking about the end of a world. 2 weeks ago, we saw how Jesus' judgment on a fruitless fig tree was his way of symbolizing God's judgment on a fruitless temple. And then last week, we looked at a series of run-ins Jesus had with a variety of religious and political leaders in the temple. Now, as he leaves the temple for the last time, here at the first of chapter 13, one of his disciples looks back and sees this magnificent temple and says, "Teacher, look! What huge stones! What tremendous buildings!" And Jesus says, "See these great buildings? Not one stone is going to be left on top of the other. It will all be thrown down. And then the original four disciples that Jesus called, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, they take Jesus aside and ask him privately this question. Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished? Now, I think it's really important as we look at chapter 13 here to notice that these questions are the context for this chapter, for the entire chapter. And it's no wonder, of course, that the disciples are asking these questions. Think about all that Jesus has said and done since he first came to Jerusalem. So, exactly what are they asking? And then let's also think about what are they not asking? And finally, let's consider what could they be thinking? Well, two things they're asking, plainly. When will this temple be destroyed, and how will we know it's about to happen? I think they're things that they're not asking. They're not asking, when will we go to heaven? That meant nothing to them. They weren't asking the question because they didn't believe there would come this time. When will God destroy the earth? Or when will all of earthly existence and time cease to be? It wasn't something that was even in their worldview. But the one thing that they probably are thinking is, when is Jesus going to be revealed as Messiah? And how is God going to bring about, in all this mess of things, the future that we've been hoping for? Because the Jews were still waiting for God to fulfill those promises that God had made to them to be a great nation. They believed God would make this all happen through a Messiah, and it would be a time that they would call the Day of the Lord. The Old Testament prophets pictured this world experiencing pain like a woman in labor before the birth of this new day for Israel. And that picture of birth pain, along with the rest of Jesus' language in this chapter, language of false prophets and wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines and the sun and the moon being eclipsed and stars falling from the sky, all that language comes from the Old Testament. That's where it comes from. And that points out that one of the reasons why this chapter is so difficult to understand is because it's so Jewish. It's based on a deep knowledge of Jewish history, and it's steeped in the word pictures, the symbolism, and the language of the prophets of Israel. And this language would be common for a first century Jew. They would understand it, but for us today, it sounds strange, and it's very difficult to understand. And so notice that it's a metaphorical and not a literal way of speaking. We do the same thing all the time, don't we? Now, if I said to you, I have some earth-shaking news for you today, you wouldn't think, oh, he's about to tell us about the earthquakes, or he's talking about an earthquake. You would think, he's got some big news for me. Something's happened in his life, or he knows something that's big news. Jesus is using the language of the prophets as you read all of these things. He's answering questions about a specific event, the fall of the temple. And the fall of the temple is going to produce this, he knows, this tidal wave of violence. Jesus wants something for his followers, doesn't he? What's he going to want? He wants them to be out of the tidal zone. He wants them to be out of harm's way. His concern is their survival. As you read the chapter, you see in verse 14, he says, the red flag you're to look for is the abomination that causes desolation. Here again, it's kind of this crazy-sounding language. And he says that's going to be set up where it's not supposed to be. Again, symbolism from the Old Testament. It's the abomination that causes desolation is a phrase from the book of Daniel. And there in Daniel, and between the Testaments, it became identified with a pagan idol that was set up by a Greek king in the holy place in the temple. And it caused a war. Jesus is saying to his disciples here, something like this is going to happen. Be looking for it. And he says specifically to them, it's going to happen within a generation. And when his followers recognize that sign, they're supposed to run. If you're up on your roof, don't go back down into the house to pack a bag. If you're out in the field, don't turn around and pick up your coat that you hung up on the fence. When this devastating sacrilege happens, and you will know it, when this person or thing or event, whatever it was, appears, waste no time. The destruction of Jerusalem is coming. Just run. And we don't know exactly what, from history, this abomination that causes desolation referred to. But Jesus and Mark, obviously, again, if you're reading the text there along with me, thought that his disciples would get it, because there's this parenthetical remark there, let the reader understand. And he's not talking about us. He's talking about that reader that stands in front of the congregation and that's reading to the congregation. Let the reader understand. So instead of putting it in writing, Mark, probably writing from Rome in this Roman context, wants to be careful about what he says here. Let's be a little bit more shaded and veiled with our language. So we don't know exactly what Jesus was referring to. But what we do know is that in AD 66, about 36 years after Jesus spoke there about the temple, conflict with Rome boiled over into outright war. And Roman armies swept down through Galilee and surrounded Jerusalem. Just as the Roman troops began to kind of close ranks around Jerusalem, back in Rome, Nero, the emperor, died. And this triggered this chain of about 4 years where there were four different emperors. There were murders, there were civil wars, there were wars within the empire, there were wars outside the empire, until finally the Romans looked all the way to the commanding officer of the troop that was surrounding Jerusalem, a man named Vespasian. They brought him back to Rome, and they made him the emperor. Well, when that happened, the Jewish leaders there in Jerusalem, the leaders of the rebellion, thought that God was pulling these strings. I'm looking at history here. Look, he's taken away the commander of the enemy's troops. So God is looking out for us. And they call at that point for all loyal Jews to join this rebellion. Come and help us drive out the foreign forces that are here in Israel. Establish a new kingdom in Israel. Competing factions of Jewish fighters splintered off, and they began to jockey for position. They actually used the temple as their command post for the war. They set up their base of command there. And they boasted that God was fighting on their side. The house of prayer for all nations became the command post in a war to kick all the other nations out of Israel. But after a long siege in AD 70, with thousands of people starving and having starved in Jerusalem, the Roman armies breach the walls of the city there. They slaughter and kill almost every person in the city, crucifying thousands. And they burn the temple. And the gold that covered the temple walls melted and ran down between the cracks of the building stones. And the greedy Roman soldiers, to get at every bit of this gold, pried up every stone of that temple apart and pried them up off the ground. And not one was left standing on another. And today, if you go to Israel, if you go to Jerusalem there, and you know the idea of the Wailing Wall. The Wailing Wall is an original part of the wall. It was part of a retaining wall to create a platform for the temple to stand on top of. So the Jews today believe that this is the closest that they can get to the temple. But very close to the Wailing Wall is this huge jumble of rocks, gigantic stones. And these are the remains of the temple that the Romans took and just pushed off the platform. They're all laying there like a jumble. But the Christians who were in Jerusalem There is an ancient church historian named Eusebius, and he writes a story, and he tells us that the Christians in Jerusalem were warned somehow before the Roman forces closed ranks around Jerusalem, and that they ran across the Jordan River into the area of the Decapolis, into the area of the Gentiles, and they lived in the city of Pella there and were saved. I wonder how they knew. They must have understood what Jesus meant. So far, so good in this chapter. We can kind of understand that part of it. But then the language gets a bit more mysterious, doesn't it? And you notice in verses 25 through 27, Jesus says this, "But in those days, after that suffering, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. He will send out the messengers and gather His elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." So what is He talking about here? Maybe this is some kind of prediction of a second coming. Again, notice Jesus is using language and quoting from exactly the Old Testament, again, Daniel chapter 7, which says in Daniel, "They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds with great power and glory." So what did Daniel, what was he talking about in context here? In Daniel 7, this figure, the Son of Man, who in some cases is suffering, in other cases he's triumphant. Finally, though, his end is that Daniel sees him in a vision coming to God on a cloud and being seated at the right hand of God. And that's this final image of victory. He's triumphant. He's on the throne with God. Notice it's not going to earth on a cloud. It's going to God, coming to God in a cloud. Jesus says something very similar to this about a chapter later, Mark 14, verse 62, if you want to look at it. He's on trial, and he's standing in front of the high priest. And the high priest says to him, "You tell us now, are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? Is that what you're claiming?" And Jesus says, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of God, coming with the clouds of heaven." And the high priest at this point has heard enough. He tears his clothes. This is blasphemy. He knows exactly what Jesus means by this. He knows exactly who Jesus claimed to be. Jesus claimed to be the Son of Man who would come on clouds to be seated on a throne in heaven with God. He's talking about that moment in time, this coming on the clouds, a moment of time, His death, the victory it wins over evil, the validation that's going to happen through His resurrection. And when His disciples see Him go, how do they see Him go? In a cloud, to be seated at the hand of God. There's the image. And you read the Bible and you realize there are, in all of these images, multiple layers of meaning for us. There's a meaning at that point. There's a meaning at our point. There's a meaning in different eyes. And God seems, though, to do the same things over and over again, kind of in the same way. So this same language about coming on clouds was first applied to Babylon, or earthquakes and fire and famine and the end of time and the sun and the moon, you know, darkening and stars falling from the sky. But the last time I've looked, the sun's out. We'll see the moon tonight. The stars are still out. So are people incorrect? What are they talking about here? There's a reason to look forward to a time when God will finish what's been started, when God will bring to maturity a creation that came into being kicking and screaming like a little baby. We believe because of Jesus' words, that our loved ones who've died are not eliminated from existence, even though they've experienced that physical death. God is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, Jesus says. God keeps those who die in Christ until that day when all who die in Christ will rise and will be given new bodies, not like these, but real, no less. And God will complete the renewal of creation. But I think it's really important here as we're looking at this chapter and we're thinking about, you know, kind of what is Jesus talking about and when are these things happening, to recognize that Jesus is first applying these things to His moment of coming to Jerusalem and what He will accomplish there and His place now beside God. Jesus believed the new world, the new kingdom, the new creation had begun. The birth pains are kicking in. Life is moving. The Christian life, as Jesus envisioned it, as we follow, is not defined by a second coming. The Christian life is defined by the first coming of Christ to Jerusalem. That's the life we live and emulate. Jesus believed His message, His mission, His kingdom was the way God was going to bring this new world into being. It was the day of the Lord, a time to inaugurate a new king, establish a kingdom whose followers would come from the four ends of the earth to the very limits of heaven. And so the destruction of the temple, it was the final validation for Jesus' disciples of all that He told them, of His mission for them in the world. It's the ultimate authentication that He was who He said He was. The function of the temple as the place where God can be present for all people is now accomplished in the life of Christ. We don't need a temple made with human hands. This life of Christ is now lived out among us, His people, people all over the world. And what's needed by followers then is also needed by followers now. It's to keep watch, to watch. Three times in that final little story there that Rick read about a doorkeeper, Jesus says, keep awake, watch. Because if you fall down on this job, it's going to have serious consequences for everybody in the house. And this kind of watching leads to discernment. Don't be misled by what you see on the surface, by appearances. Look beneath the surface. See reality. Keep your wits about you in confusing times and in the midst of crisis. The point is, don't try to time things out so that you're at your post at that precise moment when the Master returns. The point is, be doing all along, each moment, each day, be found in that place doing those things that the Master left you to do. One night, Jesus will take these same disciples, Peter, James, and John, with Him to a garden, and He's going to ask them, stay awake, keep watch. But they couldn't. They didn't. When the moment came, they weren't ready. And soon, in moments, they'd all be running away. How are these people going to stand up to a king? How are they going to take this message to the whole world? And followers of Jesus shouldn't be surprised when, for the sake of the gospel, they experience persecution or opposition. Jesus endured it, and He promised it. Jesus would be betrayed by a brother and handed over to a council. He'd be beaten and stand before a governor and a king. He'd be hated by a crowd who cried, crucify Him. He would suffer death. But in the end, as He says in verse 13, the one who endures will be saved. The kingdom of God is like a relay race where persecution for the sake of the gospel is like a cross. And it's passed from one person to the next, from you to me and on to others, from shoulder to shoulder, as we go through this journey. If you experience opposition or persecution for the sake of the gospel, that's not God abandoning you. It's just your turn to pick up the cross. Peter and John, those two that ran away, that couldn't stay awake, preached to that same Jewish council just a few weeks later, the same ones who had condemned Jesus to death. Stephen, another follower, turned a prison into a pulpit. Paul faced violent mobs, and he stood in front of kings. He was whipped in the synagogues. Paul, while he was in prison, wrote to his friends in Philippi. He's in prison. And he says, imprisonment's not a setback. Imprisonment, for me, has been the advance of the gospel. Guess what I'm doing? I'm preaching to Caesar's palace guard. And others did the same. Every time they were knocked down, they got back up and preached the same things. And if they couldn't get back up, somebody else picked up the cross for them to take that cross on their shoulders and continue the journey. The last words in this chapter are from Jesus, keep awake. Keep awake. And then it's chapter 14. And immediately, it's Passover. Passover was this night when many Jews stayed awake all night long, keeping watch, waiting for redemption, salvation. Keep awake. Passover is coming. Christians won't need to cower in fear of darkness because the sun is no longer our light by day. The moon is not our light by night. The Lord is our everlasting light. Our city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it because the glory of God is its light and its lamp is the Lamb. No matter what comes, Christ has come and is seated at God's right hand. God's glory remains. The life of Christ gives light to our lives, and the Spirit of God is always present among us, God's people. In the temple of God, not made with hands, our hope alone is now to be found.